This week's question is, do you really take your step work easy and go by the book and do every step? I think what they're getting at here is, what's the time frame for doing your steps? Do you really take your step work easy? I didn't. I was in a lot of pain when I got into this program, and I was very confused. And when people said you needed to do the steps, I wanted to do them as quickly as I could. And every sponsor seems to have a different time frame as to how quickly or slowly he wants the sponsee to do the steps. I've heard some speaker CDs where a guy said that if he gets a wet drunk in off the street, he can have him out on the street making nine-step amends in 6 hours. And the reason he does that is because he wants to get the person some relief. Now, I don't know if I could do it in 6 hours, but when I started working the steps with my sponsor, I wanted relief. And that is where the relief is in doing the steps. That's where the peace in the program is, in my opinion. So I did everything in 4 months. The people I work with, I don't have a time frame. I want them to maintain a momentum. When we start working the steps, we meet at least once or twice every week. And we keep working until the work is done. I was advised by my sponsor of a phenomenon called three and out. The people do step one, two, and three, lose their momentum, get stuck in step four because it's painful and embarrassing, and then they're out of the program. So the question, as far as taking it easy, in my opinion, no. Work as hard as you can. And then when it says to go by the book and do every step, yeah, I think you probably should go by the book. And, you know, the first time I was in this program, I did the steps at home, which I don't recommend. And there were certain steps I didn't feel were necessary, like step five. So I didn't do every step, and I got drunk again. So I don't recommend doing that either. Anyway, that's my opinion on that question. So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. So now let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 12/4/93. He has been a member of the fellowship in Santa Rosa and Fresno. He has been continually in service as a literature person, coffee maker, greeter, secretary, treasurer, H&I rep, bylaws chair, TSR, CSR, intergroup rep, and sponsor. Did I do everything? His AA motto is, willingness without action is fantasy. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Chris C. Can you hear me? Good. Evening, everybody. My name is Chris Collins. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Lost some of you there. Thank you. When I say that, I say I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That's how it's described in the early portion of the book in the Forward the First Edition. And I have. And I'll talk a little bit about my hopeless state of mind and body, and I hope to get to the hope part. I don't know if any of you like to embellish on your story a little bit, but I do have a habit of doing that. I want to thank Bill for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you 2 days ago. And actually, it was 2 months ago. He just reminded me 2 days ago that I was coming down, so I didn't have time to think about it and concoct any more lies. I'm very thankful to be here in Visalia. I've actually been coming down to Visalia the last couple of years for different AA kind of purposes. And this is the town of my birth. I was born at Coahuila Delta Hospital June 11th, 1971. My dad was stationed here in the Army, a Vietnam vet, and my mom and him moved here. And after he got out of Vietnam, and he was a recruiter down here, and I only lived here for 1 year. I spent a large portion of the first year of my life in Mooney Park, so I attribute that to a lot of my problems. And I heard about the Moonies. I don't know if anybody else had. Kind of like AA, or cult. No, I'm just kidding. That was a strangely enough, one of my my passions as a young child was I wanted to be a cult deprogrammer when I grew up. You know, I don't know what you wanted to be when you were a kid, but that's what I wanted to be. I watched some shows about that. I thought, like, that would be cool, you know, de-brainwashing people. Little did I know I'd end up in Alcoholics Anonymous, needing to be brainwashed. Parents moved up to Sonoma County. My dad got restationed in the Army. They divorced when I was 3 years old. And, you know, there's a part in our literature that says relief never comes by confessing the sins of other people. We have to confess our own. But I have this sick obsession that I think maybe it'll work someday. You know, just a little bit of background. I come from a broken family, only child. My dad met another woman, and my mom said, "No way I'm forgiving you. Get the hell out." And so he went off and built another family with this other woman, and I grew up with my mom. It's just what it was. It's all I knew. You know, I wasn't sitting there as a kid, like, thinking that I was coming from a broken family or anything like that. It was just like, sucks. I only get to see my dad every once in a while, but, like, you know, my mom's the boss. I'm going to do what she says, and which I didn't do a lot. My first episode in stealing happened when I was around 5 years old, and we went to the grocery store, and I asked mom if I could have fat gum, and she said no. So I waited till she wasn't looking, and I took the pack of gum, and I had it in my pocket. And we got home, and I felt guilty. I don't know where the guilt came from. I mean, I was baptized Catholic and stuff, and I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I don't have any position or opinion on that. I've heard a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. It probably has nothing to do with reality. It's just people's opinions. That's all we have around here, are opinions, based on our own experience, hopefully. So, you know, I put the gum in the basket in the kitchen, and then I asked my mom, like an idiot, "Mom, can I have a piece of gum?" Right? And so I didn't buy any gum. Like, no, it's right here. I found it in the basket. So immediately I was trying to cover up my lie, you know, and my lying more, and that's just kind of like is a precursor to my way of thinking, you know. I don't believe I was born an alcoholic. I do believe I had a lot of traits that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous of what makes up an alcoholic personality, so to speak, if there is one. I was selfish, self-centered, demanding. I threw a lot of temper tantrums and fits when I didn't get what I want. I was mostly concerned with getting what I wanted. I don't know if anybody can relate with that. You know, like, if I don't get what I want, I'm going to make everybody around me suffer. And I did that with my mom a lot. I didn't have my first drink until I was 13 years old. My first drunk. I knew I took sips off the dinner table, and we'd go with my mom's friends, and they'd have wine and beer on the table, and I'd always be grabbing a glass of wine and taking sips out of everybody's drinks. And it was amazing what happened. I didn't notice it was happening, but everybody else noticed that I was much more mature than my age. Like, I had opinions on things that I knew nothing about, right? And I felt free to voice them. And so they always said that, God, he's so grown up, you know? And so intelligent, so grown up. And I didn't know that was, like, the action of alcohol. Like, it, you know, everything that I heard on TV or other people talking about, I immediately formed my own opinion and thought I knew something about it. But I didn't have my first drunk until I was 13 years old. My mom was born and raised in Germany during the war, and so we went back to Germany. She wanted to introduce me to all of my family in Germany. And so we were with my cousins in this little place called Berchtesgaden, and it's one of the most beautiful places in Bavaria, Germany. And my mom and her family and some her cousins went up to this like deal like where Hitler used to hang out, right? And they're like, "You want to come and see the museum thing?" And I'm like, "Well, I just got introduced to Pink Floyd, The Wall," and I was hanging out with my cousin, and they said they're going to go to the bar, and I said I'm going with them. And
And so we went to the disco, right? In Germany, they called it the disco back then. And I looked at all these people, looked like they're having a good time and dancing or whatever. And I didn't know how to do that. And they said, would you like to have a beer? And I said, of course I would like to have a beer. That looks like what everybody else is doing, and everybody else seems to be having a good time. And so I bellied up to the bar at 13 years old, and they poured me a very tall glass of dark German beer. And I drank it quickly, and something happened where I wanted more of that, because something exploded inside of me that said, this is incredible, this is awesome, I feel I want to talk to that chick now, that's dancing over there, that's probably about 10, 15 years older than me, you know, but like I feel I could probably get her to do whatever I don't know how to do. I was a man again. Once I was much more grown up again, you know, and I just had to, but like I took the other drink down and I drank it, and the next thing you know, some time had, did anybody do time travel when they're drinking? You started drinking and all of a sudden you're in another place and it was with different people and like you don't know how you got there, but you just kind of act like everything's cool. I got this thing, right? And like I came to in the car, right? Like I didn't come to, I was already awake. I was mobile. I was awake. I was talking. I was whatever. But I wasn't passed out. I was blacked out. And I was trying to grab the wheel of the car that my relatives were driving on a icy Bavarian road in Germany, right? Because the wheel was like on the wrong side. That's when they put the steering wheel on. And I don't know if that was the reason I was trying to drive the car. I think I just wanted control of the situation. But like, and people were screaming, right? And like, the night ended, and I was falling all over myself, and I don't remember if I puked or anything, but I just know my mom was extremely upset with me and my cousins, and I wasn't thinking anything of it. I was like, that was an incredible experience I just had, you know? And like, I don't think I danced with anybody. They didn't really tell me. I couldn't understand what they were saying most of the time anyway, because I don't speak German. But it was an incredible experience. But here's the kicker. You would think that like the next morning I'd be down at the liquor store, one, another one, but that didn't happen. You know, I wish that was my story. You know, it seems like it'd be so simple. Like if every time that I drank, you know, I had this craving, right? The next morning that I had to go down to the liquor store and have another drink, you know, from the age of 13 on, like I was drunk every day of my life. I, you know, strange. I would love to have that story, right? It would have just made it so simpler, like come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I think, right? What happened that didn't happen? It was an incredible experience. We came back to the States. Somehow or another, like I turned inwards, right? I don't know if that was because I had this amazing experience, like getting out of myself, but I suddenly started to feel different at school. Like I couldn't connect with my friends anymore. There was like something missing, right? And I became this computer nerd and isolated in my room a lot with like video games and probably nobody can identify with that now today's day and age. But back in the day, that was like not a cool thing to be a nerd and to be hanging around video games and on the computer all day long. Like at my, this is 1985 or 86, something like that, 85. Like that was just not the cool thing. So I became like this, had this double life, right? Like I go to school and try to be cool and kind of, you know, have this image, and then like I go home and be this like computer nerd that I didn't tell anybody about. You know, I don't know if that has anything to do with alcoholism, right? It doesn't have really anything to do with drinking, except a few times I would hook up with some of my other computer nerd friends, and we'd get bunches of wine coolers, you know? And we'd come over, and then I'd drink them all, right? And that's one thing about alcohol, is that I never left a drink. I everything that was in front of me, I drank, and I drank it all. I didn't leave a drop. There are some sayings when I got here at a young age, at 22 years old, that I kind of heard. No, nobody ever said it directly to me, but it was insinuated. Like, I spilled more beer than you drank, punk, right? And I mean, think like if you weren't such a sloppy drunk, maybe you would have got here sooner, you know. So I just had this like vestiges of an arrogant attitude when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But what happened was that I had those few experiences, you know, and it allowed me to get out of myself. It allowed me to become somebody different, you know, and that's all I wanted. And I don't know where that came from. There's some stuff that happened as a kid, and I know there's stuff with like my family and my dad and some church stuff and some weird stuff that happened at camp. I'm not going to go into detail about, But like, I know there was stuff that contributed to my life turning inward, you know, like being, you know, completely neurotic, right? A lot of psychologists, they would call like manic depressive or whatever. I was just like intensely neurotic, you know, I would always think about myself, you know, like, you know, up and down and just completely just, you know, into me, you know, and it was like everything out there was like, how can that serve me? How can you make me feel like okay in here? Because I'm scared to death, man. And the book talks about, you know, like these traits, this actor, right, that we are. Like either we're kind, modest, patient, self-sacrificing. On the other hand, we're mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But we always got like these hooks, right? There's always a hook in it. Like, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? And just gonna skip a little bit backwards and forwards, and I do that a lot. So you know, I'm sorry if like you get lost, but like that's how I talk. I don't know, but kind of bipolar, right? But I can't take pills, so this sucks. But here's this, and I don't have an opinion on that either, but I just don't. So like I turned 15 and I got this job working at a fast food restaurant, right? And it like allowed me to get out of myself and do something and feel like a man or whatever. And you know, I'd had little jobs before, but this is like my first job that I got on my own, right? My mom was really pushing about being self-sufficient and self-supporting and kind of like that German type of like drive. You got to like do it yourself, man. And, you know, just, you know, power yourself through all this thing called life. And so, you know, I got this job and I was working. I got my first girlfriend and she was older than me. And I just completely worshiped her. And that was like my whole life. And then she dumped me and my life was over, basically. And so some of the people at this Jack in the Box that I worked at, and I'm not having an opinion on Jack in the Box, it's just like the Jack in the Box that I worked at was a crap hole. It just was, and it was mostly because I was working there, and some of my friends were working there too. And so these people said, "Hey man, come with us, come out here, you know, smoke some of this and drink some of this." And I said, "I think I will, you know." And like, God darn it, I deserve it. Look at all the pain that she's put me through, you know, the suffering. My life's over, you know. Why not? And you know, and I started doing that. Immediately, I forgot about her. Immediately, I forgot about all the heartaches and the insecurities and all that stuff. You know, it was like It was like a whole new world open up to me, you know, that experience that I had at 13 years old in Berchtesgaden, Germany, where I could just be like, I could be anything that I wanted to be, even though I had no idea what I was becoming. And that's kind of the deal, is like, I just wanted to be somebody other than me, right? And alcohol didn't just change how I felt. It didn't just go like, you know, like, ooh, you know, I feel better, or, you know, just like, oh, I'm high now. It's just like it transformed who I was. It was a magical experience, man. And, you know, And that's all I wanted. I just wanted to be something that I wasn't. And it worked, man. And I hung out with these guys, and we became like wannabe gangsters and stuff, and did a lot of crappy stuff. And you know, I always try to be the more moral of the bunch, right? And I mean, I could judge everybody else, and you know, feel like oh, I'm just drinking and doing this other organic stuff, you know, like, and you guys are doing all this stuff and dealing this stuff and whatever, and like, I got to keep you guys in line, you know. And of course, I drive. I was a designated drunk driver, and I had a car and I had a job. And I don't know if anybody knows Sonoma County or up there in the Bodega Bay area, but like it was natural for at least 2-3 nights out of the week for us to be driving up along the coastline of Bodega Bay and this like just beat the hell up 73 Ford Mustang, right? And that I had, I mean, it was like green and red oxide primer, right? Because I got in so many wrecks, and looked like a big joint driving down the street, you know. I had a coat hanger that was like holding the door closed by the door lock knob, you know. So when I'd have 3 or 4 or 5 people packed in the car, and we'd be all messed up, and I'd be going around a corner, so the door would fly open, and people would start screaming. It was like an amusement park ride, you know. And I'm not minimizing like the danger and the insanity of that, right? Like, there was just something in me where it was like, I knew that it was wrong, right? Like, I knew that for drinking and driving and doing that stuff, I mean, we had this thing in school, like sober graduation and walk on the wild side and the yellow ribbon thing foundation and whatever, all that, you know. And I was like, for some reason or another, this insanity in my mind said like, it didn't apply to me, It didn't apply to me because I could handle it, you know, because my case is different, you know. Like, I can drive drunk. I can go to work drunk. I can go to school drunk. I can do all this stuff, you know. I'm not falling all over myself all the time, although I did fall over myself a lot. But, like, you know, there's times where I could maintain that, you know. It's like I could have a lot of alcohol in my system and still function and be mobile, right? It was working. It did something for me that I could not do for myself, you know. And that's not just, I mean, like, I puked a ton. I dry heaved a ton. I did all that stuff. But that doesn't have anything to do with where I'm an alcoholic now. Plenty of friends of mine did that stuff all the time, too. One of the people that I hung out with a lot of punk rockers in the Sonoma County area. I don't like punk rock. I don't. But they drank like I did, right? And so I was, like, with them all the time, right? Matter of fact, I had different groups of friends that I'd be with because if they got burnt out, you know, I'd have another group to go with that would justify, like, what I was doing, my behavior, my existence, whatever it is. And so, like, I became a daily drinker, a daily partier, a daily drunk. And it was mainly, mainly beer. We did drink a lot of beer. There was a band out there, a punk band, and I'm not, one of the songs was Have a Beer with Fear. And it was like, yeah, I'm not afraid of nothing, you know, just have another beer, just have lots of beer all the time. And I said, that was a way of life, man. It was just a way of life. And we looked at anybody that didn't do that as you're square. You know, there's something wrong with you if you don't do what we do, right? And it was, you know, it was just being youth and being stupid and being, you know, defiant youth or a punk or whatever. I don't know. But I always try to manage this other part, you know, like have a job, you know, pay my insurance, pay my mom rent. I would pay my mom rent, right? That's so she couldn't tell me what to do, right? Not because it was the right thing to do or anything like that. It was because I'd always have that, like, to hold on to when she started getting on me about something. Like, I pay rent. I'm a man. I pay my own way, whatever. And eventually, I ended up getting kicked out. I dropped out of high school. I was still working. She kicked me out just because I was drunk all the time and defiant and destroying the household. Her and my stepfather. My stepfather is a great influence on my life, but I didn't really talk about that. But he came into my life about 15, and I put him through just terror, just holy hell. And he was one of the most decent men that I've ever known in my entire life. One of those down-to-earth guys, you know, and I believe to this day that if he wasn't there, if he wasn't kind of that rudder for my mom, right, like she would have, like, kept me there. She would have enabled me to death. She would have. And so thank God that he was there, that counterweight to her, you know, love and care and obsession with her son. And you know, Dr. Bob talks about this deal in his story. He said, some of us alcoholics pick the finest women in the world. Why they stay with us, I don't know, right? But, like, many of us would have been dead without their love and their care and their, you know, and sticking by us, you know. And, you know, I look at that like my stepfather and like my mom, because I was pretty young when I hit the streets. And that's when I ended up, like, moving out for a while and going back to school. And I graduated with a class before me, you know, and it was like, you know, just like a whole new cast of characters to party with, right? So the party was on for one more year, and I ended up graduating, amazingly enough. And my mom let me move back in that year that I went back to school. That was why I went back to school, because it was hard living on your own, working two jobs, staying on this chick's couch, right, like with her mom and parents. And then, you know, like I there was a lot of times that they would, like, be going to work in the morning, and I'd be sprawled out, like, with my clothes half off on the couch, you know, and they're, like, trying to go to school and work in the morning. You know, it was just humiliating. And that's, I didn't remember that stuff until I ended up getting sober. It's kind of weird how that happens. Like, if you stay drunk all the time, you don't really have to think about all the crappy stuff that you do and the humiliation that you put yourself through and your loved ones through. It's only when you get sober that stuff seems to come up, right? And it's kind of like my story. If I didn't ever have to get sober, you know, like, I would have never been here. I would have never got here. So Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, is not about getting sober. It's not a detox. It's about learning how to live sober, right? And that was always my problem. It's like, I never knew how to live sober. Like, it didn't make sense to me. So I ended up graduating from school and about a year, and it was just on. You know, the party was on. The liquor was flowing. It wasn't just beer anymore. It was a lot of hard liquor. You know, I'll just say, there was like a 49er Super Bowl, and I was like in this tiny little shop and we're drinking 151 Bacardi, and like I remember the kickoff, and like that was it, you know. And like people talking about like sports, and I remember like when I started getting locked up and stuff, and I remember we had like sports on the TV, and I felt like I missed out on like years of sports, because I was like, I liked sports when I was a kid. I used to play sports. I used to pretend I was Terry Bradshaw, Lynn Swan, a big Steelers fan, and I was like all this, and only because they were winners, right? Not because I'm from Pittsburgh or anything like that. I like won 4 Super Bowls, and that's me. I'm gonna be the winner, and because I was a huge fan, and so like I love sports. I love playing basketball. I love doing that stuff, you know. And like booze and that lifestyle just took all that stuff away from me. And so when I started to have to sober up, when my problems started piling up on me and becoming astonishingly difficult to solve, right? And I started to have to be put away for my own and other people's safety, right? I needed to get sober, right? And like all the stuff would like flash back, just the guilt, the remorse, the stuff that I'd done to my loved ones. And the person that I had become, the person that I didn't even know. And I remember I'd watch like Michael Jordan on TV, right? And there's like this, like the Bulls are in the playoffs and watching this stuff. And I'm just like going, I miss that, you know? Air Jordans, all this stuff, like the prime of his career. Like, I miss that. Not that that's like maybe important to any of you. You don't have to identify with that. It's just my story, you know? But here's my problem, though, right? You don't have to identify with my story. That's totally okay. But here's my problem. Once I start drinking alcohol, right, like I don't know when I'm going to stop drinking alcohol, right? I don't have any control over what I drink, how long I drink, and I don't know when it's going to end, you know. Most of the time, I don't have any control over who I'm going to become and what I'm going to do or who I'm going to inflict myself upon, right? But when I do get sober, the times that I did get sober and I was... my mom rescued me once. I tried the mission trip and I got kicked out of a mission at 20 years old. It was really bad. I tried to like live at my friend's back porch, right? And I was a really judgmental guy. I was like, when we'd like drive drunk downtown Santa Rosa, and that's where I did a lot of growing up, was in downtown Santa Rosa. And I'd like drive downtown and there's like homeless people like sitting outside, and I'd be, you know, I'd have my 32 ounce Jack in the Box and cup with vodka, you know, in my lap, and my buddy would be in the car, and like we'd drive by the homeless people and I'd be like, get a job, you bum, you know, you suck, man, you're like, you lazy bum, and all that, like, you know, little did I know, you know, that like a year and a half later, there I'd be, right? We have a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, but there for the grace of God go I, right? Like I never thought like that would be me, right? And you know what happened? I try to live off of the friends that I judge, because I judge a lot of my friends for doing certain substances that I didn't do, right? Like because I was superior, because I just drank and smoked a little of that non-habit-forming marijuana, right? That I was addicted to or whatever. But, you know, like I would judge other people because, like, they did other stuff, right? And it was ridiculous. And those were the people that were trying to help me, get me sober, right? You know, they're like taking me to detoxes. They're like, man, you got to do something about your problem. I'm like, who are you to judge me, you cokehead or whatever the hell, a crackhead? I know we call them now. But you know, it's like, we're like, here's my friends that are like doing all this other stuff that I'm deeming like, you know, the devil's workshop, right? And like, you know, I'm just a drinker, man, you know? I'm just a drinker and a peaceful hippie guy, right? And, you know, and it's like, but I'm the one whose life is completely spiraled out of control. You know, I'm the one who's losing friends left and right. I'm the one that, like, has gotten in violent altercations with his family, right? I'm the one that's been stealing. I'm the one that's been manipulating other people by, like, talking crap behind their back to try to get people onto my side, right? I'm the one that's promising things to people that I love. There's a girl that I like. There's a part in the book that talks about the moderate drinker, the hard drinker, and then the real alcoholic. And, you know, I started looking at the hard drinker once. As I know a lot of us do that if you read the book and you know, work with a sponsor and talk about, you know, the difference between hard drinking, moderate drinking, and alcoholism. And the hard drinker says he may have the habit badly enough to impair him mentally and physically. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, warning of a doctor, change of environment, or falling in love becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate. And I fell in love a lot. And anybody's had that experience? Johnny Cash used to say, when I fall in love, I fall all over the place. And maybe it was Waylon Jennings. But, you know, I did. You know, I did that a lot. And I don't know what it was, this idea that if, like, I looked more helpless, that she'd love me more. I don't know if anybody's had that experience. But But, you know, I remember meeting with this gal, and she was, and I'd known her for a while, and we partied together and done a lot of stuff together. And she really impressed me because, like, when we were drinking and she needed to go to the bathroom, we'd just pull off to the side of the road, and she'd, like, get out and go, you know, come back in. My kind of girl. Anyway, she had ended up with this other guy, and she got pregnant by him, and he took off. And I remember going visiting her on my lunch breaks at work. I worked at a Ford dealership in Santa Rosa, right after I graduated from high school. And I'd go visit her, you know, and I'd tell her things like, you know, I love you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. I'll, like, be a father to this kid. I'm, like, gonna, you know, I'm going to be there for you, all that. And, I would go there religiously. And then, like, one day, I just remember this, and, you know, I don't know if the dates and everything lines up perfectly because I'm pretty, like, you know, clouded, but I remember on her doorstep, like, giving her a kiss goodbye and telling her, like, you know, we're going to do this thing, and then promptly disappearing for 2 months, right? Like, that wasn't the plan, man. That wasn't the plan. I meant that stuff from the bottom of my heart. You know, I really, really, really loved this girl, And what happened was that all the conflicts that I was having and the drinking of that double life, you know, caught up with me, and alcohol took over. Right? And so when I came to a couple months later in a tack room in a horse stable at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds, and I remembered her, right? I don't remember what I said, right? Like, I remembered her. I was like, holy, you know, like, what have I done? You know, and I just panicked, you know, and those are the things, not about where I ended up, you know, or some of the, you know, things that I did, but just like missing out on the most important things in life, you know, just having them dissolved by my obsession to drink alcohol. A story about that, like, she came back into my life later on in my drinking, and after I'd been in a few places, and she'd heard, and she called me up, and I once again tried to try to get what I want by manipulation or whatever, I caused some harm. I caused some harm, I didn't want to hurt people, right? Like, I'm not a malicious person. We talk a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about liars, cheats, and thieves, or self-centered, self-seeking, you know, or it's an asshole, just had alcohol, or just, you know, we're just like these horrible people sometimes, it sounds like, you know. But we're not, man. You know, we're not. And the best thing in the world for me that I heard, and we were talking about it earlier, about a place up in Calistoga. There's a treatment center, and there's an old dude named Gene Duffy. And he was good friends with my first sponsor. And he was dying the same month that I got sober, but I'd listened to some of his CDs and tapes. I know some people aren't really into listening to CDs and tapes or whatever, but this guy, my sponsor, would have me listen to him. And he'd say things like, I've been to a lot of institutions, I'll throw that out there, it's not a requirement. Like I said, alcoholism is about craving and obsession. I can't keep myself sober on my own power, and once I start drinking, I can't stop on my own power. I have to be stopped most of the time. But he said this. He said that if you're feeling guilty, it's the best thing in the world for you. It's the best thing in the world for you. Because if there was no guilt there, there'd be no decency, right? Because decency is what's required to begin the spiritual path that's laid out for us here, you know? And that opened up, like, a whole new world for me because I just felt horrible. And, you know, like, I try to keep covering up by more lying and more drinking and more other stuff, you know, and just try to avoid, like, the person that I come, just deny and delude myself that, like, I could figure this shit out, right? And I've been to a lot of therapists, and I've been to some treatment centers. Oh, and my mom rescued me from this tack room at the horse stable once, and she took me up to this place called Truman's Mountain Vista Farm. It's another recovery home up in Sonoma County, and I decided I wasn't going to stay after going through 8 hours of interrogation there, right? Much like the interrogation I had to do before, like, I came up here to speak. No, I'm just kidding. How many service commitments have you had? I was like, I couldn't wait to be asked that question. I couldn't even remember, you know, because I'll tell you, I've hidden service a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous when we're talking about that, you know, because there's times that I get afraid to live. You know, I get afraid to trust God and to try new things and take risks that I'm supposed to. To grow in understanding and effectiveness. But so my mom took me to this place, And they did that like 8-hour thing trying to convince me, you know, whether I need to be here or not. And, no, my life's completely, you know, out of, just gone. But, you know, they're asking me about my drinking. I tell you, if you're asking me about my drinking when I got a job, when I got my game going on, when I'm every night doing the deal, like, okay, I'll you know, yeah. But they're asking me about what's my drinking been like the last 4 months. I've been living on the street, man. I got kicked out of the mission, you know. I'm like begging for money doing that stuff, you know, like, I mean, like, I haven't been drinking that much, right? You know, I mean, like, I've been drinking every chance that I got, and every bottle that I get, I'm drinking all of it. But, like, comparatively speaking, I'm really not drinking that much. My problem must not be alcohol. It's all the external circumstances that are going on. If somebody would just give me a job, if somebody would just give me a break, if somebody would just give me some understanding, right? Like, I'll get my shit together, you know? And, like, nobody was doing that. They were taking me to a treatment center, the last place that I wanted to be, because that was for alcoholics, you know? And I was 20 years old, a year graduated from high school, and, you know, and lost all these jobs, had a few jobs on the streets, and I'd quit so they would pay me outright there so I could go to the liquor store and buy some alcohol, right? Like, but I'm not connecting the dots there that I got a problem with alcohol, right? My problem is lack of funds. That's my problem, right? I don't know if anybody's ever had that problem, lack of funds, right? And I've since learned that the only thing worse than an alcoholic with no money is one with a lot of it. Because we can create a lot of damage and keep the illusion going for a long time and die on our living room floor with three cars, a family, good insurance. You know, all the stuff that you need to get by in life, right? And sit there and die of alcoholism because you're able to keep the props going on the outside. So took me there, and there was a sign there, and I remember seeing it. And that's the one clear thing that I remember, because some bring happiness by staying and some by leaving, right? And I pondered that sign for those 8 hours while sitting in there, and I'm like, you know, I don't want to bring anybody down here. That really wasn't it. It was like this, I don't belong here, right? Because they're talking about God and they're talking about stuff that, like, I want nothing to do with, right? Because I've done a lot of stuff that, like, is objectionable to me. I've done a lot of stuff and act in a lot of ways that I feel guilty over, that I want to figure out how to get rid of that. And this they want me to change my life, you know? They want me to stay sober. The only thing that works for me is inebriating myself as often as possible so I could figure this stuff out, you know? Like, and I'm 20 years old. Like, I'm not an alcoholic, right? And I was just like, I can't be alcoholic. And I have a vision, right? And a vision of an alcoholic is some bum on the street. Okay, I was a bum on the street. But that's besides the point, right? You know, I'm not an old bum on the street, right? You know, I don't have a trench coat. I just have this big jacket that I live in all the time that I walk around in the summer. It's a down jacket, right? Because it's my house, right? You know, like, but I'm not. I just had all these ideas, you know, why I'm not. And, you know, and I haven't drank that much, and I don't do drugs like some of my friends do drugs, you know. And that was a big thing that I had. Like, I don't do meth, so I can't be an alcoholic, right? And because I had a lot of friends that, like, they did a lot of meth so they could drink more, and so they're alcoholics. And that might be your story here, too. It's just not mine because I never did it. But that was one of the reasons, the ways that I used to rationalize myself out of surrendering to AA, right? And you know, I was not going to sell out. There. I know there's some people in the meetings that look like they had long hair and they're trying to look hip and all that stuff, like they're sober now. But I judge them as Christian rockers, you know, that they sold out. You know, their life is over and they got to do this, you know, and there's just this vestige of this ego in me, you know, that's just like, I'm just darker, I'm smarter, I'm, you know, wittier, I'm clever, I'm, you know, I'm sinister, like, you know, nobody would ever understand that, right? And I gotta figure this stuff out, right? And so anyway, what eventually happened was I left that place. My mom drove me away, and because I said, I'm not doing it. She started crying in the car, right? All right, turn around. And so she turned around, and I stayed there for about a week longer. And I remember walking one day going, like, it ain't going to work for me. And I had a lot of AA meetings, and they talked about God, and they talked about some woman talked about her horror story or whatever, and I was, like, very impressed by that. But, like, that wasn't my story. So I, like, walked out onto the driveway, and there's a line in this book. I'll read it. This is a big book, and I know, you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, condescending. I'm not trying to do it. But they told me that this is my first sponsor, Luke. He said, this is a shop manual for living life. And like, I had this dream that I wanted to just be a body and fender guy. And like, I want to be a blue collar guy and just fix cars, make a lot of money, have a lot of girlfriends and drink a lot of beer. And like, that was my ride as an American, right? And so there was this idea that's what would happen, right? And so like, he knew some stuff about me, and like, I had a car background and all that, and he said that this is your shop manual for life, right? Like, dumb mechanic that doesn't use a shop manual, okay? And like, I understood that, you know, I really understood that dumb mechanic, because my first car, it was making some noise, so I just kept adding oil to it, and like, I destroyed the motor, right? You don't put like 12 quarts of oil in a 351 Cleveland, I learned that, read the directions or ask somebody that has like followed them before. So there's this line in the book, and it kind of, Bill W., this is a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics. If anybody doesn't know, it's not written by professionals per se. Dr. Bob, we hear about Dr. Bob. There's a time in my drinking that, there was this guy named Bob that lived across the street from the house that I was in. And he was always holed up in like he had to stick or something, but nobody liked him. I don't know why. They had the nicest house on the block. That's probably why nobody liked him. But like, I'd been in and out of AA, and I'd been in treatment centers or whatever, and I was banana cakes. I was just basket case, you know, and I just thought people were following me, or so I thought AA was after me, because I kept on ending up in AA. And I lay on the porch drinking my King Cobra one day, because that's what I wish I could say, like, I was drinking, you know, 9 quarts of vodka a day at the end, you know. It was like, I was going out in a blaze of glory. Now I was like down to malt liquor and pills, right? And then back to depending upon the state. And welfare. But like, there's a guy that lived across the street, and his name was Bob, and nobody ever saw him. They just saw his wife, and she'd come out and take care of the yard and go back in, wave to people, and they had this big iron gate around their house. And like, just one day, I just like yelled across the street, "You're not gonna get me, Dr. Bob," you know. And I had no idea like anything about anything, you know. But it was just like, I was just like, the world was out to get me. Like, I'm gonna figure this stuff out, right? Anyway, let's get back a little bit. Chapter 4, called We Agnostics, and there's a lot of different terms in this book that, you know, you may not know. Like, I thought that I knew, and then later on I found out that I didn't know, and I had to look up. And agnostics means without knowledge, right? Like, and so we're talking about, like, without knowledge of an experience of God. And the 12 and 12, which my friend likes to call the Apocrypha of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a great tool. It is a great tool. I love all the literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I encourage you to find where you fit in our literature, and to see what you relate with. There's some questions in the book that say, you turn them into questions. You say, did this happen to me? Did I drink like that? Did I think like that? Did I feel like that? Do I believe that this can work for me too? You know, like, if you don't believe that it can work for you, why don't you believe that it can work for you? Why is your case so different, you know? Like, usually we find out, like, I don't know. You know, that's the answer that comes up. You know, like, why do you keep doing this to yourself? Why do you keep drinking every time that you swear that you're not going to drink again and you're going to clean up your act, you know? Like, well, this person and this and this, and because I feel this way, and we're like, the truth is, I don't know, you know? I just keep doing it, right? Like, well, and I'm an alcoholic. What do you expect, you know? Like, okay, well, the program of recovery has been introduced to you. Like, why don't you try to avail yourself of it, you know? Like, try to do what these people suggest that in the meeting that you've been going to for years in and out of institutions, right? Like, and crying about how your life sucks, right? And wanting to die all the time. You ever thought about, like, doing the stuff like they suggest? Well, it's not going to work for me, you know? I have God in there. But here's the deal. It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. And so here's me on a driveway outside of the treatment center at 20 years old, like, with this dilemma, right? And when you have dilemmas, like when you have two opposite answers to the same question and, like, they're both right, you know? You're just, if I drink, I'm going to die. If I don't, I'm going to die. You know, like, it's kind of the same answer, just opposite paths. and so, like, I was in that state where it's like I can stay here and, like, try to, like, do what these people are saying, stick with it, and maybe something will happen, and somebody will give me a place to live, and I'll get a job again. Like, that was, like, the only hope that I had. And then there was, like, and stay sober forever.
And then there was this other opportunity where I could go back down to the horse stables, right? And like maybe I'd run into somebody that night that would give me some Old English, right? You know, it was like, and like maybe then I'll be able to figure it out, right? Maybe then I'll be able to figure out why my life is so screwed up, you know? Because it can't be because of alcoholism. Besides, it's not a real disease anyway. It's just about willpower, you know? And like, I'm not going to admit that I'm weak. And so that was this idea that I could figure this out, that I could power my way through life, right? And I'll just say that it ended up in many, many different places. There's a part in this, and I'm a guy that identifies a lot with the book, Bill's story, but there's a real part in the book that talks about, like, and I think we read it earlier, these methods, some of these methods we have tried, you know, drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, you know, drinking only wine, switching from stuff. And my big thing was just like, I'm just going to drink beer and take pills and get high, and that's going to be okay. Because when I drink whiskey, like I tend to be evil. And, that's terrible. So anyway, what happened? My last drunk was actually August 25th, 1993. And I was living in this house that I told you about where Dr. Bob was across the street. And I'd been in the hospital the night before for complications of drinking and pills. And I got out of the hospital, and I walked back to the house. And on the way to the house, I picked up a bottle at the store. And then I walked back to the house from the store and proceeded to open up that bottle again. And I'd done nothing. I mean, I'm just like in pain. I'm miserable. Like I can't feel part of my the right side of my body because all the pills that they were putting me in there to keep me from, like, I don't know, or whatever. And so I drank that, and I proceeded to get in a fight with a gentleman that was living at that house, and he proceeded to beat me up. And it wasn't, it's not like it's a big deal. Like I'd gotten scraps. I'd been humiliated before by some of my best friends. It wasn't a big deal. But what happened is that the people that ran that house, is the halfway house, and there's a wonderful little lady, her name was Joni, and she's about 4'9", and her boyfriend was about 7 feet tall. I'm really not exaggerating. And, they found me the next morning, and they took me down to a recovery center in Fresno called CAP. And I remember driving down there, and the guy talking to me, and seeing a big book on the table, and I took the big book and I threw it back at the guy. Well, I didn't throw it at him, but I threw it on the table. And I'm like, screw this. And they said, well, we can't take him. He doesn't want this. And so they took me down to the local psych ward, which I was familiar with. And they said, like, we'll let you back in the house, but you got to stay here for a couple days, you know. And it was like, that was the only reason I did, because I didn't want to go back to the street again. I didn't want to go back to that, like, madness. I felt safe at that house, you know. I felt like the people there, like, understood me. They were all insane, but I felt that they understood me. And so I went in there, and I ended up detoxing there. And I spent 9 days there. And I remember getting on my hands and knees and praying. It wasn't praying to die anymore. It wasn't praying for God to get me out of this anymore. It was just one of those prayers of whatever, you know. I don't care if I have to, like, go hand out Bibles down on the street corner or you know, prophet. I don't care what I have to be. I just can't die. I can't live. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. You know, my life's over, whatever. You know, I don't know if it was that day or the next day, but a member of Alcoholics Anonymous came in. And one more time, because I've had the message carried to me many times in places like that. And he came in and he talked about some hope. And I don't remember his story. I didn't relate to him. I don't remember relating to him. But I remember at the end of our little meeting, the one-on-one meeting, he handed me a little card and it had the Serenity Prayer on it, had the 12 steps and 12 traditions. And I don't know if you say keep coming back or whatever, but somehow in that meeting I got some hope. And then the next day, an actual panel came in. And I remember getting hope there. And I didn't realize this. I didn't recognize this until I'd been sober a while. That was the first spiritual experience that I had in sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been to AA so many times before, whether in institutions, on the streets, taken by my friends. My friends would bribe me with vodka to get me to AA meetings. You know, my bad friends, right? And I used to do that. I used to talk about all the scumbags that I used to hang out with. There's people, these scumbags, a lot of them, like were trying to save my life, right? And they'd bribe me to go to meetings, but I never could identify. And you may not either. You may not relate to my story. You may not relate to all the external stuff that happened to me. Like I said, it's just my story.
But like I would always disqualify myself, and we talk about looking for the similarities rather than the differences, right? And the similarities here is the craving, the obsession, and the despair, right? It's like I was hopeless. And that's the type of alcoholic that we deal with in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the hopeless alcoholic. Chronic alcoholic, periodic, psychopath, all that stuff really doesn't matter. It's like, are you done? are you done drinking? Do you want a new way to live? Are you willing to do anything to stop drinking forever, right? To stay sober one day at a time, like forever, because this isn't about just hit a cop, sober up for a few days, you know, and like figure it out, right? This is a real deal. Like this is a life-changing program. So I was in there and I got some hope, and that's something that never happened to me before in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's that line that question that I had to consider earlier was, do I believe that this thing can work for me? And that was the first time that I ever believed that this could work for me, and I jumped on it, you know. And how much time do I have? Well, overtime? We don't wrap this up. You already know about all my service commitments, right? I tell you, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of this stuff. So my sponsor got me into this book. I was not a social guy. I was not a social guy when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew all about group therapy and everything that I thought that I knew and all the games that you were going to play. And my sponsor introduced me to this book. And I came to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous through the book Alcoholics Anonymous for doing the stuff that was in this book. You know, maybe I didn't do it completely right the first time. You know, actually my sponsor started me out on page 86. He goes, you ever been 86 out anywhere? And I was like, I got a list, you know, maybe I've been 86 out of. And he said, what I want you to do is answer these questions on page 86 and call me every night, right? And these questions were like a daily inventory, right? And at the end of that, it said, you can ask God's forgiveness. And I didn't know God or whatever. I had a lot of prejudices, and I still did. And I would do that, you know, and I would call him. And then like one day I was doing this prayer, and like I had this experience where I realized that maybe there's like millions of other people like doing the same thing that I'm doing, right? Maybe there's millions of other people that are living their life this way, you know? And like maybe it ain't so bad. Maybe it ain't so hokey. Like maybe it has some worth and some meaning to it. And like maybe I could do this forever, right? And I really wanted Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of stuff has come up over the last 18 years, and I was telling the thing earlier, I don't want to turn this into a drunkalog, so hopefully I interspersed some stuff about recovery in there, but I've had some amazing experiences. Integrating back, and maybe some of you, and I was talking to a gentleman earlier about getting out, right? And for me, like integrating back into society was a big, big deal, man. Like I did not know how to live amongst civilians, right? And like, how do you act? I mean, I knew how to do it drunk, but I surely didn't know how to do it, or I thought I knew how to do it drunk. I got fired a lot, but I didn't know how to do it sober, and I didn't know how to have relationships. I didn't know how to connect with people. I didn't know how to be a human being. And through doing the stuff that was suggested in this book, and getting with you people and allowing you in my life, you know, like allowing you to tell me when I'm screwing up, right? Being vulnerable and letting you know when I'm hurting and that I don't know, right? That I don't know. Allowing that, allowing you to do that in and through me, I've learned how to live life. I've been given another shot at life, and I'm given one every day that I get up, you know. My sponsor used to say, if you want God throughout the day, seek him in the morning, you know? Like, the first thing that I used to think about when I woke up was, like, how am I going to get drunk today, you know? How am I going to drink today? How am I going to get something in me to pull me together so I can deal with the day, right? And, like, it's the same thing in here, right? It's like, I got to hit my knees or at least pick up some spiritual literature and get connected, right? Or maybe it's a pen. And I've done a lot of writing. I've done a lot of inventories. And maybe some of you guys who are new, you're worried about the fourth step. You're worried about inventory. You're worried about making amends, you know. All I can say is, like, trust in the process. The strength will come when you need it if you trust in the process. I've done, like, inventories that have been hundreds of pages, right? I've done inventories that have been 5-10 pages, right? And I can't say which one is more useful than the other. The important thing is that it's fearless and thorough, right? The important thing is that I'm absolutely honest with another human being, and I'm honest with myself, and I'm honest with God, and I really want to change, right? And it's not so much change who I am, but change meaning stripping away those old ideas and those prejudices that have kept me blocked off from God, from me, from you, like from my family,
for my friends, even some of those people that I used to call scumbags that I drank with, right, and that I used with and did something like, they, like, stopped doing their stuff and went on with their lives, right? Like, I made amends to them, and I think, okay, we're done. I don't have to, I'm changing my playmates, playgrounds, and playthings. I'm not going to deal with you anymore, right? And, like, I've reconnected with some of them over the years, and they got beautiful lives, and they got families, you know? And, like, I get to be a part of that. I get to be a witness to that, and I get to participate in my life, in their life, in your life, and hopefully make a difference in another human being's life, another alcoholic's life that's suffering from this deadly disease. And I'll just close with this. This is my first sponsor did this with me. And if you haven't been approached by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that's armed with facts about themselves and has a solution and has something that you want, not about the outside stuff, but has something you want, that, like, they love their life today, like, find somebody, right? Find somebody. And here's a line that I can just attribute to how I was approached in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope to replicate every time that I walk up to a new person. It says that, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. But the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, but he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment, meaning how he conducts himself, shouts at a new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured, hopefully I'm not lecturing. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. And all I can share with you is that that has happened time and time again in my life when I have sought out this solution, that I've been able to take up my bed and walk again. I've been able to move past the limitations that I thought that I had erected in my life. And I believe I've also been able to make a difference in other people's lives by just following these simple directions. And you can too, because one of the things that like always pervaded my alcoholism, my story, was this inner sense of uselessness, right? Like, it was useless. And in whatever limited, stupid way, I can be useful to another human being. I ask God to give me the strength to do that. So that's it. Thank you for letting me share.